This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Yes, and welcome to the show. And I'm back this week again with Mr. Luke St. Clair. Hello, Luke.
Glad to be here.
And in a few seconds here, we're going to be talking to Wallace Thornhill about the electric universe. Before we get to that, I want to mention that I will be putting up as a midweek podcast my conversation with Laird Scranton and John Anthony West that I conducted last Tuesday. I was hoping to get the video up, but when I rendered the video, it is missynced for some reason. About an hour in. It's a two-hour fascinating interview, but I'm going to get the audio up first so people can check it out, and then the video will be up on YouTube hopefully by next week. So that was, and Laird dropped some big bombshells near the end of that interview, and the interaction between the two of them is just fascinating. Plus, you get to see a little of John Anthony West's house. All right. So, as I said, we're going to be talking here with Wallace Thornhill. Hello, Wallace. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
And you are still in Australia, right?
Yes, for the moment.
And next, it's next month now, you have a conference in Arizona.
That's correct. 25th to 29th of June. And it's at Phoenix.
Okay, and that is the Electric Universe. This is the big conference you do every year, right?
Yeah, the Thunderbolts Conference, which is based around the electric universe.
Okay, and how many years have you been doing it?
Let me think. I think this is the fourth year.
Oh, is that it? Seems like you've been doing them longer than that.
Oh, yeah, prior to that, we had a lot of meetings, which were sort of ad hoc. But these, having one every year, gives people an expectation of being able to meet up and chat at least once a year.
Hmm. And who do you have at this one?
Well, we got quite a lineup. Apart from Don Scott, who's the professor of electrical engineering and has been working on the electric sun, electric sky. His book is called The Electric Sky. My colleague that I've worked with since 1997 is David Talbot. And we have Professor Jerry Pollack, who'll be talking about beyond water, what makes the world go round, talking about the fourth state of water and its critical nature for life itself. Montgomery Childs, who's an engineer who ran a big engineering company and is now the head of our Sapphire project, which is looking at proving the electrical model of stars. We've got Ben Davidson from he runs the show Suspicious Observers on suspiciousobservers.org and looks at the electrical nature of earthquakes. Does the sun trigger large earthquakes? Dr. C.J. Ransom, who's a plasma physicist and who I've known for many years, will be looking at, called Close Encounters of the Star Kind is his first talk. And talking about the idea of uniformity being used to support the claim that mythology was only created in the minds of the writers. He'll be showing that that's not true. We've got Dr. Franklin Anariba, who'll be talking about the electrochemistry of comets, since comets are an electrical phenomenon. Michael Steinbacher, who's interested in plasma catastrophist geology, and that is the formations we see, particularly in the U.S. Southwest. And he talks about them in electrical terms. Dr. Tom Wilson, who will be talking about the siren song of certainty, which shows the rather odd way that science or human beings behave anyway when doing science, and that is they're attracted to a kind of groupthink and the difficulty that we have these days because of the institutionalization of science in breaking free from that and actually introducing really new ideas. We've got a number of other people. Dr. Bruce Laybourne will be talking about climate change and the Earth as a stellar transformer. With Duarte Cardona, who's written the definitive works on the earliest memories of mankind and the history of the solar system. Dr. A.P. David, talking about the metaphysics of Michael Faraday. And Ignacio Cisneros, who's a very good friend and who's doing amazing work in analyzing images from space and looking at the filamentary structures which are indicative of electric currents in space. Ev Cochran, who's a colleague of Dave Talbot's and has been for decades, looking at planetary catastrophe in terms of ancient myths and modern science. We have another chap who I haven't met yet, talking about solar system formation. And Dr. Pierre-Marie Robitaille, now he's doing very important work looking at Kirchhoff's claims about thermal emission and showing that Kirchhoff's laws are actually mistaken. And not only that, that Max Planck's trying to claim that Kirchhoff's laws are universal is incorrect as well. He's working with Stephen Crothers, another Australian, a good friend, who looks at general relativity and a case study in numerology and shows that the mathematics behind it is flawed. And anyone who's followed it since and claims to understand it, their mathematics also doesn't come up to scratch. We have Reverend Robert Strait, who's a PhD in engineering, revisiting our understanding of classical physics and relativity, because this is obviously one of the big themes. We've got Dr. Gary Schwartz looking at extraordinary ideas and extraordinary evidence, and he's done amazing work at the University of Arizona. A couple of other people I haven't met before. Richard Moore's talking about the pulsating universe and planet Earth, looking at electrical the spiky nature of electrical current and its implication in terms of cataclysm and ice ages and climate. Wayne Byrne, who I haven't met yet, talking about the structure of interplanetary discharges and the effect that has in cratering and showing that impact craters can only have been made by lightning bolts. We've got another chap talking about plant electrotropism. And this gives you an idea of the broad range. Once you are looking at the underpinnings of science, and cosmology is supposed to be the queen of the sciences, the umbrella under which all of the others fit, once you start producing a new cosmology, then it has effects right across science and also culture, cultural activities. So we have artists involved at various times. Michael Armstrong's talking about the culture shock of planetary catastrophe. And then we have David Novak, who's our master of ceremonies and an amazing guy. His ability to weave together the disparate subjects and talks and speakers is quite something to behold. He's quite a performer on his own. So it's going to be a great show.
It sounds like it. My God. That is one hell of a lineup. And how many days is it?
Well, the 25th to the 29th, so that's 4 days.
Wow.
I think. Yeah, actually, the first evening, of course, is open to the public, I think. So anyone who wants to come and have a listen can get some ideas of what's happening over the following 4 days.
Okay. And who puts this? I mean, I know you have a part in putting it together. Is it mostly David Talbot out there kind of putting the details into everything?
We have a great team of volunteers now, and without them this would not be possible. In particular, we have somebody managing the conference, Susan Sherratt, who's quite an amazing organizer. And we expect to be doing live streaming on the web this year for the first time. We have people involved in that activity who have shown themselves to be extremely professional. So we're looking forward to this first for the Thunderbolts conferences.
Wow. Okay. And that, I'm sure people will be able to find more about that at thunderbolts.info?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. And that's where you can go for all the info on this conference, as well as you guys put so much stuff into that site. You have a video of the week that comes out. I mean, there's just so much information that's on a constant stream out of there from so many different people. It's utterly fascinating.
Yeah, it's so easy because science is reporting surprises almost on a weekly basis. So we've always got more material.
And a lot of these surprises aren't surprises to you.
No, this is the encouraging aspect of the electric universe. We're open to new ideas all the time. But these surprises, as they come in, we have a look to see how it fits with the big picture, as we call it. And we haven't had any difficulties at all fitting these surprises to the electric universe cosmology, which is, of course, how a replacement cosmology must operate. It must be able to explain things better than the old one.
Right. And as an example of that, do you want to explain a little bit about Comet 67P and what they expected versus what you guys have been saying about comets all along?
Yes, well, back in the at the turn of the 18th, 19th century, scientists were talking quite openly then about the electrical possibilities of comets. But that all got squashed for some reason or other, and the history of these ideas is always very interesting to trace because you often find where we make the big mistakes. And the big mistake was made when it was decided that electricity played no role in cosmology. And that is a quite amazing thing to do because electrical power, we just can't do without it.
Right.
In modern science and technology and day-to-day living. And yet it doesn't play a role in cosmology. And yet the electrical force is so much more powerful than gravity. I mean, gravity is so weak that it's essentially zero compared to electricity and magnetism. And yet here's this almost zero force being given as the driving force in the universe. And this, of course, is why we end up with black holes and, you know, these monstrous things that gobble everything up, because gravity is all they've got to work with. So anyway, getting back to comets. It was recognized early on that the features of a cometary display were similar to those seen in the old gas discharge tubes. You know, this glow that you can get in a low pressure gas. And of course, the solar system is an extremely low pressure gas. The flaring of comets is also an electrical phenomenon that you see on cathodes when they light up. And the jets also, cathode jets, is the kind of thing that they use in industry in spark machining. And this has been recognized too by people in the industry who've joined us, that all of these features make sense from the point of view of electrical discharge machining. Now, so when we look at the jets on Comet 67P, we are not expecting ice to be the responsible for it. In fact, it can occur from high points, sharp points, and so on. And this is what we've observed in the past, that it's the sharp edges of craters and things on a surface which tend to get eroded away. The other thing about Comet 67P, and this gets down to our complete lack of understanding of gravity, is that its gravity suggests that it's kind of fluff ball. You know, it's not even solid ice. It's must have a lot of empty space inside, so it's porous. Well, when you look at Comet 67P, it looks like a piece of rock. And my suggestion early on was, if it looks like a piece of rock, then that should be your first assumption, that it is rock. But of course, the gravity says, no, it can't be. But when you understand the electrical nature of gravity, because gravity is, in effect, in the electric universe model, a very weak dipole electrical force that's down at the subatomic level. That's why it's so weak. You know, it's the kind of effect from electrons and protons and neutrons, the bits that make up atoms. And a comet is in a very odd environment. It's quite different to the Earth. It's in the sun's environment. There are no large bodies nearby to affect its atomic structure. So it has a very weak gravitational field, but that doesn't mean that it's not made up of rock. And also being in the sun's electric field, as it travels rapidly, more and more rapidly towards the sun, its electrical environment is changing, and in response to that, it begins to discharge. And that's, of course, is what we see.
Okay. And the established view of comets is pretty much that they're just dirty balls of ice.
That's right, sublimating gas, and the gas is blowing material off into space. But if that was the case, you would not expect to see these very fine collimated jets coming off the surface. Because if you blow a hole in the surface and there's material underneath trying to escape into space, it'll do so, tend to do it in an explosive way. In other words, you won't get a fine jet. That would only happen if you happen to be machining nozzles for jets on the surface of the comet, and there's nobody there to do that.
So the official explanation of comets, if I'm not mistaken, is that they are left over from the creation of the solar system. They are out in the Oort cloud and occasionally get knocked loose and come into the inner solar system.
Yes.
Where would you say, what are in the electric universe theory, what are comets and where do they come from?
Well, the standard story is based on the idea that the Earth and all the planets and the Sun were formed from a rotating disk of gas and dust. That theory has never been shown to work. I was at a meeting of astrophysicists a year or so ago, and an expert on solar system formation admitted that you needed a different theory for every planet. And that's the clue. In the electric universe, stars and planets, the large ones, are built in effect in a cosmic lightning bolt in a molecular cloud. And this is exactly what the infrared telescopes like Herschel has observed. And the surprise expressed at the time was that the stars appeared to be like beads on a string, on a glowing string. Now, this doesn't fit accretion theory at all, but it does fit the plasma cosmology and electric universe model precisely. Now, under those conditions, you form planetary systems by bodies in that lightning bolt. After the lightning bolt fades, they then capture one another to form systems with multiple stars and with multiple planets. And the surprise expressed by those who have looked at, by now, more than 2,000 exoplanetary systems is that none of them seem to make any sense according to the standard theory of how the solar system was formed. In fact, we look like the odd one out. Now, this is a sure indication that your theory is failing. But science doesn't operate on failing theories. What they do is they get more and more complicated answers and keep the same theory. Anyway, in the process of capture, bodies have to adjust electrically to their new environment. And in doing so, they often have to eject material, because one way of achieving electrical stability is to just get rid of a part of yourself, get rid of that charge, which is charged matter. And so comets and asteroids and all the debris floating around in the solar system are the remnants of previous capture events. And the solar system, because all of the gas giants are at a great distance from the sun, must have been captured. None of them have any relevance to the formation of the sun. They were captured later. That's why it's such a fruit salad of objects in this solar system. And the electric universe story, which we'll be talking about at this conference, is what happened in the last episode of Capture, because that impacted humankind dramatically. And we still haven't recovered from the after effects, psychological after effects of that.
Now, is that the end of the last ice age?
Yes. The ice age was part of it. In fact, there is no climate theory that explains ice ages.
Right. Now, do you think there was a shift in the poles? What do you think happened at the end of the... during that started the ice age and ended it?
All of the evidence points to the fact that we were part of the captured bodies in the last... And the last ice age was part of that phenomenon. The story is It would out science fiction any science fiction story, simply because, as often happens, you know, fact is stranger than fiction. But we have all of the evidence in place now to be able to quite confidently point to the last phases of that capture episode in which the Earth was involved. And the ancients recorded at that time these thunderbolts of the gods, as they called them, these interplanetary discharges, and that's the origin of the material that's floating around in the solar system now. In fact, that's the very reason why Martian meteorites are still landing on the Earth.
Hmm. Okay, so we were captured by the solar system.
Yes, yes.
Now, is this the Saturn hypothesis here?
That's right. We call it the proto-Saturn story because Saturn, in its former existence, outside the sun's electrical environment, was a brown dwarf star. And it's fascinating that in recent years, astronomers have finally come to the conclusion that life would be well suited to begin around as a satellite of a brown dwarf.
Okay, and when it got into the sun's environment, it lost some of that charge.
Well, in the process of capture, proto-Saturn would have been a phenomenal comet of its own. And the discharges involved in that one would have been quite amazing. And this is the kind of thing that's been recorded around the world in petroglyphs. And that was a critical moment in our development of this work, was the coming together of high-energy plasma physics and the mythological evidence of these interplanetary discharges. I made the initial connection with Dave Talbot back in 1996, 97. And that's when we realized that the convergence of the science that I was doing and the reconstruction of the mythological stories, the global mythological stories, was the thunderbolt. It was the electrical interaction. And, of course, when that was established, it became obvious to me also that in Australia, our Aboriginal people here have legends of the Lightning Brothers, and their depictions show things which you'd expect from the high-energy plasma lab experiments to exist, but which they could not have known about. The very fact they describe these things is very strong forensic evidence in favor of the work that we're doing.
Hmm. Can you give us sort of an overview of what would have happened?
yes. Provided you don't, disbelief doesn't cut in and you just listen.
Mm-hmm. No, that's fine.
Okay, we were a part of a brown dwarf stellar system, and Saturn, or proto-Saturn, which would have been a larger body than it is now, was our sun, if you like. Now, if you could imagine Saturn or Jupiter today, and if their magnetosphere was lit up, you would see something, for instance, with Jupiter, if its magnetosphere lit up when we were closest on the same side of the solar system as Jupiter, we would see Jupiter as big as the full moon. Hmm. Now, that is the extent of its electrical environment. Now, a brown dwarf has a very large electrical environment, much larger than the central body. Just like the sun has, its electrical environment extends out 100 times the distance of the Earth from the sun to the heliosphere.
Right.
But in the case of brown dwarfs, this electrical environment is lit up as a glow discharge. So it glows red. So brown dwarfs, although they're small stars, actually their glow is much larger than the star itself. And if you can imagine, if you're on any of the moons of Jupiter or Saturn, you would be inside that red glow. And it's known that if you are inside a glowing shell, it doesn't matter where you are inside that shell, you will receive the same amount of energy on your surface, regardless of where you are, how you're moving, and so on. So the Earth at that time had a very benign environment for life, and there was no latitudinal difference. In other words, the poles were as warm as the equator. There was no night and day because the light was switched on all the time, if you like. We were inside the light. And so there was no such thing as night or day. It's interesting to try and speculate on how that must have been. But the light was remembered as dim, and it was purplish because you get both the red end of the spectrum and the blue and ultraviolet in those electrical systems. So it was the purple dawn of creation as it was remembered. Now, as Saturn came close to the Sun's electrical circuit, it began to suffer adjustment problems. And this is one of the things that's been noticed about brown dwarfs and has puzzled astronomers, is that they tend to flare. That's their only way of adjusting to their environment. So proto-Saturn flared up. And that was the sudden brightening, let there be light, you know. Suddenly, everything lit up brilliantly. And this glow tended to clear somewhat. And as we drew closer to the Sun, proto-Saturn itself, the actual physical body, proto-Saturn, developed a shining crescent on one side. And because at this stage, proto-Saturn was under this electrical theory of gravity, it tends to get accelerated towards the Sun, away from its satellites. So the satellites were strung out behind it, rather like the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. We were sitting in the cometary tail of proto-Saturn. Mm. The plasma environment there was recorded by the ancients, and they saw these what's known as plasma instabilities, and there are about 80 of them. But they recorded most of them. The ones they tended not to record were the ones that were lethal. In other words, the plasma discharge itself was emitting X-rays of such intensity that anyone out in the open trying to chisel into the rock what they saw in the sky wouldn't have lasted very long.
Right, right.
Now, all of this became evident once we teamed up with the plasma physicists. So the proto-Saturn was captured by the solar system. In the process, of course, it would have had to have reasonably close encounters with some of the other bodies in the solar system, and the principal one would have been Jupiter. And it's possible that Jupiter was responsible for dislodging the Earth from this unstable arrangement of planets strung out in a line. It's interesting that Venus was observed as being born as part of this phenomenal discharge from proto-Saturn. And so Venus became the archetypal comet in all of these ancient stories. In the case of the Australian Aborigines, that was the rainbow serpent that sculpted the surface of the Earth. So these things are really, they sound like total fiction, but we have an enormous amount of evidence in favor of them. And what's more, the predictions and the expectations that come from this new cosmology are being met regularly with new discoveries.
Now, how long ago would this have occurred?
This is a difficult one, but the last ice age was part of the process. So you're looking around 12,000 years ago, something like that. But of course, the process of adjustment, although it was rapid because there was electrical exchanges involved in transferring energy, and that's part of the stabilization process. That's why the solar system looks like clockwork today. The whole thing seems to have taken place around 12,000 years ago, 10 to 12,000, but there would have been repercussions, with objects flying around and creating havoc and fear in mankind of another near total wipeout. That was our fear of doomsday. That's where it comes from. And it seems that we still suffer from it today, because we seem to always need to have some kind of disaster in mind, which we're all going to die from unless some miracle occurs or man can find out a way to fix it. And the climate change is the latest one. It's funny to realize that it's only a few decades ago scientists were telling us we're in for a new ice age.
Right, right.
But since they don't understand ice ages, that prediction was false as well.
So what was the ice age?
The ice age was known as, it was the Fimbul winter of the Nordic gods. It was the twilight of the gods. It was when we were lost touch with our former sun. Hmm. And it's interesting that the words for Saturn, the names for Saturn, are the ones that we now have transferred to the sun, like Sol and Helios were originally the names of Saturn. It drifted off and became just a speck of light in the sky, and we had to find our new home in the solar system. That involved electrical adjustment of our orbit, and also Venus. Venus had to find its place. So between Mars, Earth, and Venus, there was a lot of activity until we settled down. And so those repercussions would have lasted over thousands of years, possibly down into the era before, around the time the pyramids were built and so on. All of those major undertakings were in response to man's desperate need to try and establish control over nature again. That was the driving force behind all of that monumental architecture and so on, and worshipping of gods and whatnot.
What about Göbekli Tepe?
Yes, it shows signs of having the same origin.
Hmm. Okay. But do you think they were recording devices or worship devices?
No, I think in each case it was an attempt to try and, as man has a tendency to do, try and gain control over nature. In this case, all they could do was to try and mimic what they'd seen in the sky, as if that would somehow appease the these out-of-control planetary gods.
So, was in the electric universe theory, you comment on the connections to mythology. Was there a cosmological event that was recorded cross-culturally?
Oh, yes, yes, this is the whole thing. A forensic investigation requires that you treat all evidence from different cultures as you would from unreliable witnesses in a police investigation. But the amazing thing is that when you use that technique, you find that there certain themes occur, doesn't matter where you look around the world at these ancient cultures. And those ones are the ones that you can be fairly certain. In fact, they're the ones that I've used to try and reconstruct the cosmology of the Earth, the solar system, and how it all works.
And what themes were these? Like, can you give either pick one particular culture or a general overview?
Oh, no. The most ancient ones are the ones that we pay most attention to. Hmm. And any references to what they said or wrote or chiseled into rock is what we use. In fact, the petroglyphs, which are prehistoric, were some of the most telling evidence that we could find for what we reconstructed independently of the plasma physicists. So that was really, I think, that was where the convergence really began to solidify into a coherent theory, both scientific and cultural.
What did the petroglyph show?
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
What did the petroglyphs show that were chiseled?
Oh, the petroglyphs show, for instance, the squatter man symbol. Now, the squatter man looks like a chap with his legs and arms out at right angles, arms upraised and his legs stretched out. And the odd thing is that between the elbows and the knees, there is often a spot drawn or a circle. Now, the hourglass shape, which is what the squatter man is, a representation of looking through a plasma discharge from side on, that has that squatter man shape. It has the raised, it's like an hourglass, with the top part is stretches out and upwards, and the bottom half stretches downwards and outwards. But in the plasma discharge, you have a a circle of plasma around the center. And that appears, when you look at it edge on, as two bright dots or circles between the knees and the elbows, if you like. Now, this is repeated around the world. And there are hundreds of thousands of these petroglyphs dotted around the world. And so a study was begun by the chap who was the Tony Perrett, who was the expert in plasma instabilities. He'd studied them. And so he began an investigation utilizing the help of volunteers in various countries, including quite a few here in Australia, of recording photographically and with GPS the position and the magnetic orientation of these things, with the aim of being able to reconstruct in 3D the appearance of these things in the sky.
Wow. Okay.
All right.
And that study showed what?
Well, one of the interesting ones that came up in the early studies was that you have a radiating circle pattern which was used by the North American Indians. And it was possible to show that we had here in Australia a similar, well, it was almost identical pattern, but it was offset, as you would expect, from the two different points of view on the Earth's surface. So in other words, what they're representing was something seen in the sky from two different positions on Earth.
Wow.
Okay. And those patterns were those of a plasma discharge.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with Wallace Thornhill.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight we've been talking with Wallace Thornhill about the electric universe theory. And you've just given us an overview of the concept of the destruction that happened at the end of the Ice Age and what and us being attached to Saturn and so on and so forth. This wasn't something you came up with overnight. This was something that slowly developed over a number of years.
Oh, yes. Decades.
And some of this started with Velikovsky's work, too, didn't it?
That's right. In fact, I give credit to Velikovsky for having introduced me to the forensic style of investigation of ancient stories from around the world. And his idea that Venus was a comet within the memory of mankind, and my great interest in astronomy as a student at high school really inspired me to read more, and it resulted in meeting up with him actually just a few months before he died in 1979. I was working for the Australian government in Washington, D.C., and I called his home, and he graciously agreed to meet with me and my family. And so I drove up there in 1979. I think it was in April. And I think he died in November of that year. But my question for him at the time was, if Venus was a comet in man's memory, then it's quite obvious we don't understand celestial dynamics because you wouldn't end up with the clockwork solar system you see today.
Right.
And I said to him the biggest problem that he faced with having his ideas looked at seriously by scientists was that it appeared to disobey Newton's laws, Newton's law of gravity and so on. And so I said to him, what is it we don't understand about gravity? And he went climbed the stairs to his library and came back with a slim volume that he'd written back in the 30s, I think it was published in the 40s, called Cosmos Without Gravitation. And he said it was a preliminary work and he didn't want it widely distributed, but he gave it to me, and in there was the idea that gravity had something to do with normal matter and the separation of charge within normal matter. Now, this happens as a regular... I mean, this is the reason we exist, is that atoms distort when they come close to one another and they form these molecular bonds. And quite a lot of them, most of them, are these distorted atom-type electrical bonds. And so he said it was something along those lines, and there were a lot of ideas that put forward which interested me. But that meant that I had, if you like, a prepared mind, because 2 years later, I think it was in the Scientific American in 1981, I think it was January, there was a tiny advertisement for the Journal of Classical Physics, and the chap responsible for it was Ralph Sansbury, an independent researcher from New York State. And so I wrote to him, and I got a copy of his issue, which was called Electron Structure. Now, according to the way physicists, particle physicists, handle electrons, they're treated as a point electric charge, which is physically impossible, because the energy involved in, a point is non-physical anyway. So it's a mathematical convenience. And that interested me because that offered, as Ralph Sansbury showed in his small volume, it showed that you could explain magnetism and derive Ampere's law from the very simple idea of having an electron with a kind of atomic structure. In other words, it was made up itself of smaller charged particles orbiting at phenomenal speeds. One of the other aspects of that was that it also gave a handle on how gravity might work in terms of this tiny distortion of subatomic particles in an electric field. And he developed that, and I was very interested, but it took decades for me to come up with a slightly modified version of Ralph's work, which I felt answered most of the questions. And it started to form the idea of the electrical nature of gravity. Mm. And it answered the main questions. Why is gravity such a tremendously weak force? I mean, it's about 10 to the minus 39 of the electrical force, you know, between two charged particles. And that is as close to zero as you can get, practically.
Right.
And it's the reason why we're not reduced to something a micron thick on the surface of the Earth. You know, if we were subjected to the raw electrical force, instead of that, we can jump off the Earth. We can function quite happily in Earth's gravity. So the development of all of these ideas came initially from Velikovsky's work, and because it involved the trying to reconstruct what the ancients were desperately trying to tell us with their stories, and the people like the Australian Aborigines with their oral traditions seem to have remembered details for thousands of years. They felt it was extremely important to hand this information down to subsequent generations. The problem for us is that none of the things they were talking about make any sense to us, simply because we've never experienced anything like it.
Right.
And hopefully we won't.
Now,
go ahead.
When we were removed from this environment around Saturn, how come we didn't end up like Mars?
Well, we could very well have. But Mars, interestingly enough, the ancients described exactly its situation. After Saturn gave birth to Venus in a brilliant outburst, like a nova-type outpouring of material, it went into orbit initially about proto-Saturn, and because it was born from proto-Saturn, it was given a backward kick. That's why it has that odd rotation, retrograde rotation, because it was torn from its parent before it had time to set up a gravitational phase lock. Anyway, the ancients witnessed that, But when Saturn began to be accelerated towards the Sun, it was pulled like a pip out of the center of the its little planetary system, and its satellites trail behind. Closest to Saturn was Venus. It was the newborn one. Beyond that was Mars, and then there was Earth. Now, Mars was in the unfortunate situation in this plasma discharge from Saturn of acting as an oscillating charge carrier between Venus and Earth. So sometimes it was tiny, and it seemed to be retreating into its mother's womb. And there's a lot of stories about that. And then at other times it approached the Earth closely, so closely that it must have been absolutely frightening. And then it was the giant. It was the giant that supported the heavens and fought with thunderbolts. It was the planetary god of war. And so it suffered terribly. And the evidence for that is written all over its surface now. It has kilometers of material ripped off its northern hemisphere, and it has a cratered southern hemisphere, and it's the kind of difference you would expect from the electrical model of discharging, acting as a cathode in one discharge in one hemisphere and an anode in the other, is exactly what would give you the effects we see. The giant gash across the face of Mars, which stretched for a third of the way around the planet, Valles Marineris, was observed by the ancients and recorded. Mars was had a scar face. The American Indians called him Scarface.
A couple of things I wanted to get to before the end of the show here. One of the things was previous ice ages that the Earth went through. What was happening in those instances versus the most recent one?
Well, the one of the questions is, how did we survive if we came in from outside the solar system and then were stripped off from proto-Saturn?
Yeah.
Maybe somewhere between Mars and Jupiter's orbit. Where we find the asteroids is likely where a lot of activity occurred, because the asteroids are debris from that kind of event. And so one of the things is that in the process of orbital capture, the electrical model shows that it's transfer of electrical energy which is involved in stabilizing the orbit. And that electrical energy would have had heating power. It would have heated the Earth to some degree. So although the radiation from the Sun at times would have been very much less than we get right now, at some point in our orbit, it'd be like having a cometary orbit with terrible winters and terrible summers. And that is what the ancients complained about at various times, about the Sun being too far away or too close, and the sky having to be lifted. There are a lot of stories like that.
But don't we have a cycle of ice ages, though, that go back hundreds of thousands of years?
No, what we tend to do is, because of the clockwork Newtonian model, there is this tendency to look for cycles which don't actually exist.
Okay.
The problem is that the very act of trying to date things geologically is based on radioactive dating. Now, radioactive dating assumes that radioactive decay is a constant process.
Right.
But if there's any interference from outside, particularly with the energies involved in cosmic thunderbolts, then the clocks are smashed, they're reset, all sorts of strange things will happen. And also it's been shown recently that radioactive decay is not a constant, it depends on the environment. And even the Sun affects radioactive decay, our relationship to the Sun. So we cannot use radioactive decay as an accurate dating system.
Just a quick question. Could you explain what a cosmic thunderbolt is?
Cosmic thunderbolt is an electrical discharge between celestial bodies, two planets. And it doesn't take the form of normal lightning, because lightning in the Earth's atmosphere is a thin filamentary type of discharge. In space, what happens is you get a thing, it forms a structure in a near vacuum. An electrical discharge will organize what matter is in that vacuum to form a structure called a plasmoid. And this is the kind of thing that was done, or the experimental work was done on decades ago, in the early decades of the 20th century. It's just unfortunate that plasma physics took a while to get off the ground compared to standard physics, and therefore a lot of the ideas about what the sun is and so on were set in place by people who knew nothing about plasma physics, which is unfortunate.
Now, like the scar on the planet Mars, that would have been done from a cosmic thunderbolt.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. In fact, I've written on my website a description of what happened, because it took me a long while to figure out what it was precisely that was represented by that scar, because it has a distinctive shape. Mm-hmm. And that shape became clear to me when NASA published a picture showing the topography in different colors. And then I realized that that shape is that of a barred spiral galaxy. And in plasma cosmology, a barred spiral galaxy is the grandest form of electrical discharge in the universe, in the visible universe.
Hmm. Okay.
Interesting.
One of the things I wanted to ask you is a little bit off from what we've been talking about, but does the electric universe theory have any consequence on theories of consciousness?
Yes.
How so?
Because at the very heart of the particle physics of the electric universe is the fact that all matter in the universe is connected in real time, effectively, at least in the local universe. It obviously cannot be of infinite speed, but it's certainly far in excess of the speed of light. And the other thing is that so-called quantum events are merely the instantaneous resonant interactions between atoms, molecules, and particles. And this explains a lot of the so-called weirdness and strangeness of quantum theory. And of course, quantum theory is being called on to help explain consciousness. So it gives you the impression, and it's an impression, that we are a part of something much bigger than ourselves, and that consciousness is a part of it. And it's not just, it's not in the brain, it's everywhere, if you like. We're a part of something grander than ourselves, because we represent a connection with the, if you like, intelligent universe.
Hmm. Okay. Question from the chat room. Someone wants to know if you would say consciousness is then inherently electrical.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it is an electric universe. And I mean that not just at the, the planetary interactions and so on, but at the subatomic level, everything is connected electrically. It's the electric force which explains all the others, magnetism, gravity, the strong nuclear force, and so on. It's all electrical.
Okay. And Cosmo Snake would also wanted to know if plasmoids came from space or also from the Earth.
They can do either. It depends on the polarity of the discharge, which way it goes. But the plasmoid is—it's like a. It was described by the ancients who witnessed these things or remembered them, as like a coal spat out of a fire. In other words, it's an object. It has a physical appearance, and it moves from one planet to the other. So it's not like a lightning bolt at all. In fact, if you look at the carvings, the statues and that of Zeus hurling his thunderbolt, that thunderbolt that he's hurling looks like a football-shaped corkscrew.
Great.
That is one representation. Another one is the Tibetan Dorje. It looks like a dumbbell with a very intricate pattern. That intricate pattern is part of the plasma discharge.
All right. You have anything you want?
Maybe if we could touch back upon an electrical model for a star. I've always been under the impression that we've observed thermonuclear reactions coming from the sun and can measure its radiation. How does the electric universe theory kind of mix in with that, or does it?
Yes, thermonuclear reactions occur at the sun, but not in the sun.
Okay.
The brightness that we see of the sun is all atmospheric. Got nothing to do with anything going on inside the sun. the electrical energy that the sun receives is catalyzed by in the solar atmosphere. In fact, we have seen, I mean, the evidence for the thermonuclear reactions is the neutrinos that we receive. But that's such a fuzzy image, you cannot tell where they're coming from. I mean, the sun is just at the center of this fuzzy image.
Right.
So it's there's never been any proof of the reactions that are supposed to take place in the center of the sun. It's all theoretical. And not only that, the theory is so damn complicated that you need a different theory for every different kind of star that you see. It is extremely complicated. The electrical model is very simple, and it explains red giants, white dwarfs, pulsars. They're not neutron stars. There's no such thing. And it's all one simple model.
Cosmo Snake also wanted to know, this is a great question, is there a main electrical source emitting from somewhere, or is the sun producing electricity itself?
That's a good point. One thing about electrical energy is that you can generate it in one place and send it for great distances and then use it somewhere else, and this is what the universe appears to be doing. We cannot say, this is part of the ongoing investigation, of course, where the power ultimately comes from. It's like one of those where did it all begin questions. Mm-hmm. We don't know the answers. We can begin to ask more sensible questions, however. What happens is that clouds of plasma, ionized material in the universe, when it's moving relative to other clouds of ionized material, will generate electric currents in each other. So that can be part of the answer, but it's not the full answer, because when we look at galaxies themselves, the galaxies are strung along intergalactic power lines. We can actually detect the power lines by their radio emissions and so on, and also the orientation of galaxies, which is not explained by Big Bang cosmology.
Now, it's almost like a string of Christmas lights.
That's right, yes. They're strung along power lines, just the same as the stars are in spiral galaxies. They're strung along the spiral arm power lines.
Hmm. All right. And I would think that different suns and different, like the red dwarf or a brown dwarf versus a red giant, is a difference of how much power they're getting?
Yes, it's the difference between the central object's electrical potential and the plasma environment it happens to find itself in. And a red giant is a star that expands its anode, if you like. This is how it works anyway. It expands its anode to collect enough electrons to satisfy the discharge. And in doing so, it appears an extraordinary size. But that size can vary quite rapidly and unexpectedly, and it's not explained by the standard model of red giants. They also tend to have very strong winds. Now, these are a cool star. Where do they get the strong wind from? Hmm. Well, the strong wind, when you expand the anode glow, it accelerates particles, and those accelerated particles create that strong wind from red giants. And when you come to white dwarfs, a white dwarf is a star like the sun, but it doesn't have a bright photosphere. It doesn't require a photosphere to modulate its discharge, so it just has a corona. And that faint white glow that we see during a total eclipse is what a white dwarf is. It radiates strongly in X-rays rather than in visible light, and this is what we observe with white dwarfs.
And what about supernovas?
Supernovas are an electrical explosion. When you break a circuit on a high-voltage power line, and you can see videos of these on YouTube, say a 500,000-volt, half-million-volt intercontinental power line, you get this enormous release of energy and this great spark that arcs for meters up into the air. That's what happens to a star if it breaks the circuit. And you can do that in plasma physics with what's called a double layer. And a double layer can actually pinch the current off if it gets to a certain density. And it seems that a supernova is one where the electrical discharge causes an imbalance in the electrical stress inside the body so that it actually spews its insides out. And this is exactly what's been observed and has puzzled supernova experts because they said it seems to turn itself inside out. Hmm. That's not explained by the explosion model.
When you're looking at all this stuff, when you're looking into deep space, are you seeing a direction from which all these electrical charges are traveling?
It's the radio astronomers that are important here because the radio astronomers can track the magnetic fields generated by those electric currents. And one of the speakers at the conference this year, Ignacio Cisneros, is actually, he's doing what they call the blink, you know, where you superimpose two images and then just blink from one to the other. Mm. And he's finding changes in dust clouds. These electric currents tend to aggregate dust along their length, so you can sometimes pick them up as dusty filaments. And he's doing that and showing them changing rapidly over a short period of time, which is not expected gravitationally.
Oh, all right. We're just about out of time. Your site is holoscience.com.
That's right.
The main Thunderbolts site is thunderbolts.info, and the EU 2015 Paths of Discovery is in Phoenix from the 25th to the 29th of June with a list of speakers you went over at the beginning that is just amazing.
Yep. This is one of the good things, too. We're attracting all sorts of scientists and engineers and lay people who some of them are actually doing experiments in their garage, would you believe?
But you do have a lot of accredited scientists behind this theory as well, including yourself, obviously.
Well, that's right. This is what we expected. We didn't expect an overnight acceptance of any of this. It's just a case of those scientists who are, you know, the real scientists, the ones who are looking for the truth. We'll see which side better answers their problems. And eventually, those with the courage will make the jump.
All right. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us, Wallace.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And good luck with the conference.
Thank you.
And we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation. This is Whirring World.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Number 1597 and counting.